intergalactic planetary, intergalactic planetary. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. It is the Matt McNeil Show. I want to thank all the members for being here, because once again, it's not the regular airwaves. It's the members only page. Hello there. How you doing? No, I asked about if we could have content like that, and they have specifically said, no, we want you guys to stay members. Thank you. Thank you very much. From the bottom of our heart, we appreciate you being a member. Helping keep AM 950 on the air for the 2020 election cycle. That is so important. Thank you so very much. We've got, of course, on the special members only page, we are going to have special interviews here. But one of the things that I wanted to do was revisit some of the interviews that I have done and kind of, you know, talk a little bit about the perspective of it. And one of the ones that was truly for me, a remarkable interview was Robbie Massey. Robbie, his story is intimidating, at least to me, on a lot of levels, because, you know, first of all, I want to make sure we say this. This wasn't a book. This is a friend of mine, his son. And I've actually gotten to know Robbie fairly well. Recently, got married and, he still does some adventure stuff. He still goes, travels the world and stuff. But, you know, here was a guy, one of the first times I ever was introduced to Robbie Massey was his dad coming over to me and says, well, he climbed Denali and he's skiing down. I said, wait a minute. He's skiing down Denali. Skiing down the tallest mountain in North America. I mean, I'm no expert at skiing or mountains per se, but I kept saying to myself, is that really a good idea? I mean, isn't that technically falling? And he did, and he had a GPS tracker on, and I was able to, and it took him a while to get down. It took him, it was 2 days to get down all the way down the mountain on skis. And I'm going to guess he needed a Nutri-Grain bar or something like that after that, because just the physical strain of coming down a mountain like that. He did it. Just amazing. And he fell in love with mountains. And then he went to climb Everest. And he was in the process of climbing. He was up on the mountain. And the earthquake struck Nepal. There are a few jaw-dropping moments I have in this interview where I'm as the person who's supposed to be the interviewer, I am more a listener, and I am just, what? There is a part of me that doesn't do certain things. I don't get into a bathysphere and go to the bottom of the ocean. I don't go to mountain climb. I mean, I've climbed some mountains out in the Appalachians, which are, a few thousand feet. I think 5,000 is the highest I've been up. And it's a great view. It's a lot of work getting up there, by the way. There's a little uphill to that. The ones with roads, they got ones out in the mountain, the Rocky Mountains. You can drive up. Oh, trust me, a lot faster. And you will not need to take as nearly as many breaks on the way up if you can drive. Car doesn't like it so much, but you can, there are a lot of places you can go and climb. And to get into this level of the tens of thousands of feet, is not an easy thing. It takes years and years to do it. And yet, on a flip of a switch, these people all of a sudden go from being seasoned pro to deadly liability. Like that. And I don't climb mountains that big, and I don't have any intent, because God forbid I was at the top of one of those things and I fell and I cracked an ankle. And then all of a sudden I'm saying to myself, well, if someone's going to pull me off this mountain, they're going to have to jeopardize their lives. I mean, I was reading about on Everest. I think this was before Robbie Massey was caught up there on the earthquake. The efforts that they were making to try to identify climbers who had died, who'd fallen and died, and that they would go up there and they'd send people up there. And just the mere act of trying to figure out someone identified there is clearly a body that's over off this ridge that someone needs to go over and identify. And just the mere act of going over there just to try to find a name, to kind of give some closure to the story or to the family, that itself was that dangerous. I can't do that. And part of me does have this mentality as well. When you climb up that high, you know, that was your decision. That's your call. I mean, that's, you know, you want to, to a point, it feels to me a little bit, if you want to go out and try to dodge semi-trucks on the highway, you know, you probably shouldn't try to do that, because if it goes wrong one time, you're not going to come back from that. But these people do this because they love the adventure. They love the sport. They love the climbing. They love the view. I mean, the view really is, you know, pretty spectacular. But no one on that mountain that day was thinking they were about to deal with an earthquake. I won't share some of the specific details because it is harrowing what Robbie Massey went through on the mountain to get down. But it also came with the afterthought, being in a country which was, you know, didn't have a lot in the first place. Basically, its main GDP is on people climbing mountains, you know, people doing that. But to be down and not have any idea how you're going to get out of that country, how you're going to get out of the community, that and seeing so many people suffering, it was a pretty stark moment for Robbie. I do not lie when I say this might be, in 30 years of radio, my most favorite interview I've ever done. It is something I had Robbie actually go over. There is a woman, a teacher at my kids' junior high, and they usually do a segment on Into Thin Air, the John Krakauer book. And they talk about climbing Everest. Well, the expert they were going to have was not available. And so I suggested to the teacher, Miss Johnson, maybe I could get Robbie. And she came back and sent me this note. She goes, this story is so much better than just – because it's so much – it's not just about climbing the mountain, because you do get that. But it's about survival. It's about perspective. It's about it's about being grateful every day for what you can and cannot do. This interview is amazing. So here you go. I'm going to leave you with this. Enjoy. It's Robbie Massey, his story of climbing Mount Everest, right here on AM 950. Robbie Massey, if you are a real fan of the show, remember when Robbie was on with us before, a while back, you were climbing Denali.
Yes, that's right, back in 2010.
You climbed Denali, and then you skied down Denali.
Yeah, yeah.
That's a pretty good trick. Have you been climbing mountains, many mountains, prior to this year in that stretch?
Yeah, so I lived out in Montana for 9 years, and I climbed a bunch of mountains out in Montana and Colorado, and just started to get into the Seven Summits. My buddy was out in Nepal and climbed a 20,000-foot peak, and so I wanted to one-up him. And so actually that same buddy and I went up to climb Denali, and we ended up going unguided and got up there and skied it, and it was a great experience up there.
Who doesn't want to go climb Mount Everest? I mean, it's one of those, you know, few unique experiences you can have left on this planet, where you do still feel the you can still see the footsteps of the explorer that went up there the first time. It's kind of one of those, you know, must do, especially if you're a rabid mountain climber. So the idea of wanting to climb it is not a surprise. When did you make the decision that we need to change the training and we're going to go and we're going to try to achieve Everest?
So I decided I wanted to embark on this mission about a year before, and it was in May, and I was talking to my girlfriend about it, and I just decided, you know, look, if I'm going to go for it, the time is now. I'm not married. I don't have kids.
Yeah.
I've got the time to train, and so I decided about a year out, and I went through a pretty rigorous training program. I set up about a 32-week training program, training 6 days a week. You know, I work out in the gym with you, so you probably saw me on the Stairmaster. I was on there about 3 hours a day, and with a 40-pound pack on, and just drenched in sweat. So it was pretty intense training for sure.
Is that something comparable? Is that something that you can kind of pick up in regards? I mean, that you can just get on a stair climber with a pack like that, and that's going to give you, because the one problem that you really can't mimic here is the air, the lack of oxygen.
The air or the mountains.
Yeah, exactly.
So another thing we did do is we went to Buck Hill, and we made about 20 laps a day on Buck Hill with a pack on. You know, climbed up, skied down kind of deals, and make it a little quicker. But yeah, the Stairmaster in the gym is definitely the best correlation to actual mountain climbing. It's it's definitely tough training, but it's the best substitute for actually hiking in the mountains.
There is also one of the things here. I mean, Nepal is a country. It's not exactly got a lot of wealth, but they have basically they look at this Everest experience and they try to they make money off it. This is a very costly, time consuming process to get to Everest to go climb this mountain. Correct?
Oh, it's very expensive, very costly. The whole trip, and you're exactly right, is very time consuming. It takes about 10 weeks to do the whole expedition up Mount Everest. So. It's a big chunk of time. It's a big investment of money as well. And, you know, it takes a lot and it's a big chunk of your life. But in my mind, it was well worth it for the potential and the experience of getting up there.
You fly what, into Kathmandu?
Into Kathmandu, yes.
All right. And then because one thing is, it's not like, you know, even some like Mount St. Helens or something like that, where you can actually drive relatively far up the mountain. This is, you have to start with 3 days of hiking to the base camp, correct?
Yeah. So actually it was, we took 11 days to get up.
Okay.
So we fly from Kathmandu into the mountains. And this is a really unique experience because you land on a mountain runway. And the mountain runway is called, it's a short takeoff, short landing runway. And so it's really only about like, you know, 300 yards long. And so, and it's up on like a 20 degree angle up into the mountain so you can stop quick enough and take off fast enough. And it's just on this cliff. So you're flying into this cliff up onto this runway and you just slam into the pavement and it's a really abrupt stop and everyone on the plane screams. And so that's kind of like one of the most exhilarating experiences on the flight in.
Oh, it's like an aircraft carrier on an angle.
Right, exactly. That's exactly right.
Oh my god! So you land there, and obviously you know find your stomachs again.
Yeah, exactly.
And then from the airport, what's the path?
So then from there we trek up and we stop at multiple little towns along the way, and it's a great experience. You get to experience the Sherpa culture, and these people have lived up there for you know hundreds and hundreds of years.
Oh, yeah.
and they kind of migrated up there to find peace, and it's a really unique culture, and you know they thrive off tourists coming up every summer, and it's really fun just to get in and be in that culture and spend time with them, and they're such nice and amazing people, and the towns are so unique. They're just perched on these mountainsides above cliffs and gorgeous scenery all around. So the whole trek, I did the trek with my girlfriend Erin, and the whole trek was just absolutely gorgeous. Just stunning mountains, stunning views everywhere you look.
Mm-hmm.
You're climbing, you know, right below 20,000, 25,000 foot peaks that are just breathtaking. And, you know, I'd highly, highly, highly recommend the trek up to Everest Base Camp to anyone listening. And it is just such an amazing
experience. Not to climb it, but just as far as a natural experience to be in that cathedral of mountains. I've also heard from other people. It's just stunning.
Yeah. Tens of thousands of people actually trek up to Everest Base Camp each year. So it's a big tourist attraction. It's, you know, you don't have to be in great physical shape to go up and do that. You know, a good training session would probably be a smart idea before you went out on it. But, you know, I've got lots of friends that have gone up and actually done the trek to base camp, and they agree with me. It's just a gorgeous experience.
Robbie Massey joining me right now as we're talking about his experience in Nepal from April. Robbie, so your girlfriend, was she planning on climbing the mountain with you?
No. So my girlfriend, Erin, is a technical rock climber. So she climbs, you know, a lot of sport climbing, climbing up, you know, a little steeper, more technical routes than mm-hmm. mountaineering routes. So she just wanted to come to base camp with me and share this experience with me. So
she was in base camp then?
Yes.
Okay.
So she made it all the way up to base camp. She did an amazing job. She all spent right. 2 nights up at base camp, and then she actually took off and headed home back to work.
Sherpas, obviously the natives of the high mountains of Nepal, a fascinating culture, just a fascinating culture and just a unique part of this world. You as well, though, to get up there, you have guides that are such an important part. And it's I don't want to call it an industry because it's like calling a lifeguard an industry to tell a point, you know. These people are the more experienced climbers that have, for the most part, all these guides have climbed multiple times up to Everest, correct?
Correct, yes. And the Sherpas are absolutely amazing climbers. And I went in there thinking that I was in good shape compared to a Sherpa. Not even close. These guys would make laps up the mountain all the way up to Camp 2 and back within 5 hours, which when we climbed it, it took us 5 hours just to get to Camp 1 the first round. So they are incredible. They carry unreal amounts of weight on their backs.
Mm-hmm.
Hundreds, up to 200 pounds they're carrying on their back of loads of wood for building materials, supplies for base camp, whatever you need, generators, water heaters. I mean, this is, there's no roads. You can't take a car up where we are. So everything needs to be carried up by foot there.
Well, and also, I mean, it just in a kind of a cultural aspect of that region. I mean, you had to go down into the valleys to get the building materials of a traditional nature or food and then haul that back up the hill.
Right.
Incredible.
Yep.
These tours, I mean, this is not like if I go into the back of a travel magazine and I pick up, a phone number there and it's like, you know, go cruise Nova Scotia or something like that. How do you get involved with this? And talk a little bit about the guides that you had up on the mountain with you.
So I did a bunch of research before this trip, before I even decided to go on which guiding company I'd like to go with. And I decided that I wanted to make sure it was a legit company, an American company. And going up with guides that, on paper, I would trust with, mm-hmm. with my life.
Oh, yeah.
And so I found RMI, Rainier Mountaineering Incorporated, and I was looking at their website and I saw that Dave Hahn and JJ Justman were the guides for the trip. And I read all their bios and I'd heard of Dave Hahn before about, mm-hmm. From reading mountaineering books. And Dave Hahn has the most summits of any non-Sherpa in the world, which is really cool. He's got 15 summits out of 22 attempts. And I think the record is a Sherpa. I think he's at 19 or 20, somewhere around 20. But it's quite remarkable what he's done with his career. And Dave was actually on the team. He led the team who set out to try to find George Mallory and Andrew Irvine.
I remember the reading about that they were lost on the mountain, and they actually did find them. Was he on the team that found them at that point?
Yeah, so he was actually guiding that team. Yep, with a bunch of good technical climbers, Conrad Anker. Yep. And they found Mallory on their first trip. And so what they were looking for, because if anyone that doesn't know the story, Mallory and Irvine tried to summit Everest in 1924. They're trying to be the first people to summit Everest in 1924. And no one knows if they actually made the summit. Mm-hmm. They were spotted about 300 vertical feet short of the summit, and then a cloud came in. So no one saw them, and no one saw them until 1999 when they actually found Mallory's body with the team that Dave led. So it was cool. They were looking for a camera. They knew they had a camera. They didn't find a camera. So there's actually still no proof of whether or not they actually made the summit. So
when you go on this trip, and by the way, if you want a great explanation, someone one time told me in referring to climbing mountains of this nature, that imagine you're chartering a fishing boat and they're taking you into the worst hurricane you've ever seen with 90-foot waves, and that's where you're going to go fishing. So when you're talking about guides, that's the level of expertise. It's not just the fact that these people know they're climbing. It's that they're knowing climbing in the worst conditions. And really, it is. I mean, as it's most beautiful conditions. It's the tallest mountain, but it is a mountain that can change in a heartbeat, correct?
Absolutely. And guides are really someone that you want there when something goes wrong. So I was really lucky to have the best guides in the mountain when the earthquake occurred.
You get to base camp. How long? I mean, and for the novice here, it's base camp, then there's camp 1, 2, 3, and 4, and then the summit, correct?
That's correct, yep.
All right. The base camp, how long, when you get into base camp, how long are you there before you start your ascension?
So a normal trip, you take about a week or two to acclimate. So base camp is at 17,500 feet, so you're up there. And so you usually take about a week and a half to 2 weeks to acclimate before you start making your acclimatization rounds up the mountain. And usually those rounds, there's about three rounds. So you start off by heading up the mountain through the icefall to Camp 1, and spend 3 nights at Camp 1, come back down to base camp, spend a few days, and then you head back up to Camp 1, then Camp 2, spend 5 nights at Camp 2, all the way back down, then all the way up Camp 2, spend a night at Camp 3, all the way back down to base camp, and then you go for the summit.
What is it? It just because you are going up so high into the sky that the oxygen, that it's going to help you acclimate? I mean, is that just, I mean, obviously this is a trial and error thing. They figured out that this is the best way to get people up the mountain.
Yep. The safest way to get people up the mountain is to climb really, really slowly. And your red blood cell count actually doubles by the time you're up there. So the general rule of thumb in mountaineering is you want to climb high and sleep low. So if we're sleeping at base camp trying to acclimate, we'll always go on treks or climbs up to, 18,000, 19,000 feet during the day and then come back down and sleep at base camp. That just always helps with acclimating.
How, you know, just for, you know, a knowledge here, and I'm presuming you know this pretty well, probably off the top of your head. Camp one, what are the elevations of each one of the camps?
So you got base camp at 17,500. Camp one is at 20,000 feet. Camp two is at 21,500 feet. Camp three is at close to 24,000 feet. Camp four, high camp in the South Col, is at 27,000 feet, and the elevation is over 29,000 feet.
So when you're going from base camp to camp one in a 5-hour stretch, you're going 2,500 feet further up in the mountain.
Right. And so the most dangerous section of the whole climb, everyone would probably think it's the last day of the summit push up to 29,000 feet. It's actually the first push up from base camp to camp one. You go through the Khumbu Icefall, which is notorious if anyone's read Into Thin Air. It's very dangerous.
Yeah.
So the Khumbu Icefall, it's a glacier that comes out of the western Khum between Nupsi and the west shoulder of Everest and comes into bottlenecks down towards base camp. So it's a very condensed version of the glacier. It moves feet a day. There's towers of ice that collapse every single day. There's new crevasses that open up every single day. It's pretty much a war zone in there.
I've heard from people. I'm saying this as the novice, as the non-climber. Obviously, the air, the elevation, the oxygen levels. But the two parts which really give the most challenge are that first stage, and then there's a little shift up to the top. There's a rock thing where you have to kind of wiggle your way around that thing as you get to the top.
Yeah, the yellow band. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So I've heard that those are the two really. I mean, that, you know, granted, I'm not trying to simplify this because this is still just climbing. This is insanely difficult to do, even if you're just walking in a straight good path. But there are some stretches on this mountain which even for skilled climbers are a real treacherous stretch.
I wouldn't say for skilled climbers. I think that it's a pretty straightforward climb, and there's definitely a lot of dangerous spots in it. For any technical climber, it's pretty basic and straightforward, and there's fixed lines all the way up the whole mountain. There's ladders set over all the crevasses, so the technical climbing is very limited. Your challenges are surviving in high altitude and really putting one foot in front of the other and trying to make it to the top when you're at 29,000 feet, which is the cruising altitude of a jet. So.
When you were up at – you made it up to camp one. Was this on – were you doing the staging of preparing yourself, or were you actually at that point you'd set yourself up and you were actually climbing the mountain?
So we had set ourselves up. We spent about 2 weeks at base camp. We got trapped in a storm down at base camp. That's why it took us a little long to get up the mountain and start our rounds. And, so we made it through the ice fall. We were up at camp one, so we were on our first round of acclimating. Mm-hmm. And, we're just living up there. We did lots of hikes up there. We actually hiked up to camp two. We touched camp two and came back to camp one. We spent, 3 nights at camp one before the earthquake hit.
And that takes us up to April 25th. Robbie Massey is joining us. He was on Mount Everest on April 25th when a disastrous earthquake hit Nepal and shook that mountain like I mentioned early in the show, like a snow globe. Robbie, we're going to take a break. Come on back. We'll talk about the earthquake itself. Robbie Massey joining us. It's The Morning Grind right here on AM 950.
The Morning Grind with Matt McNeil, the hipster cat dude of Hopkins. On AM 950.
AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. It is The Morning Grind. Matt McNeil, Brian, 732. Robbie Massey joining us. Robbie was on Mount Everest, Camp 1, to be precise, when the earthquake hit the 25th of April earlier this year, a 7.8 earthquake. This was a midday for you guys at Camp 1, correct?
That's correct, yes. Yeah. So we had just come back down from touching Camp 2. So we were getting up a little bit higher to 21,500 feet to acclimate. And that took us all day. We went up there, came back down. It was about midday, a little bit before noon. So we'd been at camp one for about a half hour. We were taking our boots off. We were boiling some water for drinking water. And and then everything started to shake.
This earthquake was not epicentered at Everest, though. It was further into the country.
That's correct. I believe it was... I think it was about 50 miles west of Kathmandu.
Okay.
I don't know the exact location, but it was not, the epicenter was not around Everest. And there was actually a second earthquake 2 weeks later that was right by Namche. Bizarre, which is a town on the trek up into Everest. But this one, the big one, was not.
But it's still, I mean, describe that. You are on, I mean, how much of an angle are you standing on? I mean, is it a plateau or is it like an airplane port?
Yeah, this is an interesting, our campsite on Camp 1 is right at the top of the Khumbu Icefall. So the Khumbu Icefall falls down 2,500 feet down to base camp. And we're camped right on top of it. And, you know, it's still a very broken up part of the glacier. So we're camped on this narrow ice fin. So this ice fin jets out from the glacier, drops off 30 to 50 feet on either side into huge crevasses. So even further than that. And the whole ice fin's about, 20 to 30 feet wide. So we're camped up on this ice fin that spans the width of the Khum. And so when the earthquake happened, I had no idea. I'd never been in an earthquake. I had never experienced shaking like that. So I actually thought the whole ice fin that we were camped on was crumbling down the Khumbu Icefall. And I thought we were falling down towards base camp. So, you know, I had my my socks on. I stuck my head out of the tent. I was getting ready to run and jump whatever direction this thing was falling. And I looked to the left towards my guides. There's three tents with other clients in the tents too, and everyone had their heads out. And our guide yells out to us, you know, stay calm. It's an earthquake. So I realized, all right, this ice fin is not collapsing. We're just in an earthquake. So just to give people perspective on how much this was shaking, this is a 7.8 magnitude earthquake. In Kathmandu, there's areas that were moving up to 12 feet. Mm-hmm. So buildings collapsing, everything obviously. So up and down, side to side by 12 feet. We were moving between 5 and 6 feet up and down, side to side. So
And this is Mount Everest.
Yeah.
This is being picked up and shaken like a salt shaker.
Right. So then you think about where you are and, the environment you're in. We're camped, it's about a half mile across this narrow section that we're camped in, and then towering peaks above us. So you have Nupsi on one side, which is, 6,000 feet above you, and the West Shoulder on the other side, which is, 5,000 some feet above you, with huge hanging glaciers on mm-hmm. them. And this is one of the main dangers of climbing Everest is these glaciers, these seracs, will break off and cause an avalanche that come down and sweep through, the Khumbu Icefall or Camp 1 up at Everest. And our guide, actually, when we got up to Camp 1, he made us move our tents because he said, I've seen an avalanche come off the West Shoulder before and destroy, 70 tents right in this area. We're not camping here. And so, right during that section, during the earthquake, when we're shaking this much, we hear all these seracs, all these hanging glaciers breaking off. And it's just a numbing feeling to know, this could be it. These are huge glaciers that are breaking off, coming down. There's nowhere for us to go. We're going to be in an avalanche here.
You're looking at a frozen version of the Mississippi River tumbling down on you. You were Camp 1 wasn't hit directly, but base camp was. Was that what was happening? Was all this was coming past you and shooting down past over the falls?
Right. So I'll kind of explain what happened. So there was avalanches off the West Shoulder and Nupsi. They were just very minor compared to what happened to base camp. But we actually did get hit by an avalanche. It was mostly just debris that had calmed down when it reached us. But, when the earthquake happened, we were frantically trying to zip up our tent flies, get everything closed up because we heard the seracs break and we knew something was coming down. We could hear it roaring towards us. And it actually did hit us. And I put my hands up on the tent and kept the tent from collapsing in. And it was kind of a big wind blast of ice and snow that nailed us. I'd say, 6 to 12 inches of snow that ripped through our camp. But our whole experience up there was just minuscule to what happened down at base camp. So, Everest is climbing up one side of base camp, and then Pumori, which is another huge 5,000 foot peak, whatever it is on the other side of base camp, kind of the back side of base camp. Mm-hmm. So it's a very large peak, and again, lots of seracs, lots of hanging glaciers up on Pumori, and I've seen before and after pictures of Pumori, a huge section of the ridge, just massive amounts of ice broke off from mm-hmm. Pumori and fell 5,000 feet all the way down to base camp. It didn't hit directly into base camp, but the pressure swept the avalanche through base camp. It destroyed full middle section of base camp. And when I mean destroyed, I mean completely destroyed. It it ripped tents, it threw gear a quarter of a mile, half a mile out into the glacier. It absolutely destroyed everything in its path. It picked up a person that was standing in the wrong spot and threw her 20 yards. It was a big hit. And especially for something like that to happen at base camp, where when you're up there, you kind of view that as your safe zone. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm in base camp, I'm safe, I'm not climbing the mountain. You know, it was a big hit to all of us. And we're sitting up at Camp 1, you know, for 3 days. We were stuck. We couldn't get back down through the Kumba Icefall. We had no clue at all what happened. And our guides did a good job of keeping everyone calm. We heard our base camp manager, Mark Tucker, talk a little bit on the radio. He did a good job of keeping it calm and not mentioning any specifics on the radio. But, you know, my tent was right next to our guide, so we could kind of tell that something was wrong just in the tone of Mark Tucker's voice.
Quite a few people did die down at base camp.
Yeah, so 22 people died, I think, is the updated stat.
We'll take a break here, but quickly, Camp 2, Camp 3, Camp 4, and anyone up on the summit, what was the story on those areas there? Did you hear, were they having avalanche problems?
Yeah, so this is pretty early in the climbing season, so the highest any team had gotten was Camp 2.
Okay.
Yep, and I think there was something like 70 people up at Camp 2 and close to 100 at Camp 1 when the earthquake happened.
And at Camp 2, were they hit like you were, or was it more serious?
There's a small little avalanche up at Camp 2, but it was not that serious. And I think there was just a couple injuries of people trying to run away from the avalanche.
Robbie Massey is joining us right now. When we come back after traffic and weather, we'll get more. Of course, we'll continue where we're at. He's at Camp 1. The earthquake just happened, and he is stuck at Camp 1 on Mount Everest in Nepal in April of this year. 952-946-6205. Traffic and weather in 2 minutes right here on The Grind.
The Morning Grind with Matt McNeil on AM 950.
AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. It is the Morning Grind. Robbie Massey joining us. When we took the break there, the earthquake had just struck on Everest as you were up at Camp 1. You were, first of all, you know, just the reality of it. How small did you feel on this planet at that point?
Minuscule. You're right. It felt so small when you're up there. You know, I felt small even before the earthquake occurred. You're walking among these giants, these gigantic mountains that just tower above you. It's pretty humbling to get out in that environment. And then for, you know, the earthquake to occur, you know, again, it's just sitting there like I had no idea that the earth could shake like that.
You are up at that point at 20,000 feet at Camp 1. You have just climbed to get up from base camp, which you know has been struck by something. You're not aware of it, what it is yet. But just in the rational thought process, you're at Camp 1. You need to get back down to base camp. But as you described, as you're going up here, you went through probably the toughest part of the entire climb as far as dangerous climbing environments over that glacier. It clearly, as you talked about, there's ropes, there's ladders that are set up. At this point, you're imagining nothing is in place anymore and that you're basically almost free climbing back down.
Right. So the Khumbu Icefall is pretty much impassable by 99% of the people that attempt to climb Everest without ladders and ropes and all the safety equipment set up to get you up through that section of the climb. So when the earth shook like that and everything's moving 5 to 6 feet, all the ladders fell into the crevasses. So these ladders, you're climbing over these 60-foot deep crevasses. You know, you're walking over them. You're climbing up vertical ladders, up, you know, vertical sheets of ice. It's a crazy jungle gym through this section of the glacier. And so you imagine the earth shaking, you know, with a 7.8 magnitude earthquake. And, you know, these ladders, they break, they fall down crevasses, new crevasses open up where you'd need to place ladders over. So everything was a mess. So, you know, our guide, highly respected Dave Hahn, up at Camp 1, you know, helped organize a team to go down from the top to assess the damage and see how much damage had happened in the icefall. And he also sent two of our Sherpas up from the bottom to try to meet in the middle and see how far each of them can get. Well, our Sherpas got about a quarter of the way up and told Dave on the radio that this is not passable. We see one ladder's down over a big crevasse and there's multiple down, you know, up higher on the mountain. And so they booked it down. And everyone is on edge right now because of aftershocks and, and everything happening.
And I want to bring that point up. You need to get people down off this mountain because the threat of aftershocks is very real, that even if you were to set up another, you know, a trail back down, that trail could be wiped out by an aftershock.
That's exactly correct right there. And so what happened with three of the guides that went down from Camp 1 is they actually got stuck in the Khumbu Icefall during, I believe it was over a 5.2 magnitude aftershock.
Yeah.
And you know, I don't know if you've seen Vertical Limit or any of the mountaineering movies where it's almost surreal, it's almost unrealistic with the special effects and how it's going, and they're running and jumping and trying to catch on things, and, you know, crevasses are opening up. These highly respected guides came up, and they were white, and they were saying, this is what we just went through, and we're lucky to be alive. There's crevasses opening up left and right of us. There was one strip that we could run on. That's where we ran, this one strip during this aftershock, and we were lucky to get back up to Camp 1.
How did you eventually get down from Camp 1 then?
So then all the guides had another meeting after that attempt failed to reach the middle and re-establish a route down through the icefall. And they determined that it was too dangerous and that the earth was too unstable for anyone to go down through the icefall, and just morally, it was not right to send Sherpas, to send guides, to send anyone through the icefall. It's just way too dangerous and careless with people's lives. So, you know, Dave Hahn was one of the main people to go into the meeting and say, look, I'm calling the helicopters. I'm calling a rescue for my team. You guys can do whatever you want. And then by the time he said that, everyone was on their satellite phones calling the helicopters.
Yeah.
And so it was, you know, it was 160 people, I believe, that were rescued from Camp 1 and Camp 2. And this is flying helicopters. So the helicopters would fly from base camp. There's three helicopters, fly up from base camp, land on the ice fin that we are camped on, so, you know, 20 feet wide. You'd run in there, keep your head down, get in the helicopter. There's no chairs, nothing in this helicopter because they're trying to keep it as lightweight as possible. You're flying up at, you know, 20, 21,000 feet here. Very dangerous flying helicopters up at that altitude. So we want to try to keep weight really down. And it, you know, they rescued 160 people up from Camp 1 and Camp 2 all the way down to base camp.
You then go to base camp, you hike back out, and your goal now is to get out of Nepal back to the United States. But I imagine just everywhere you go, the devastation was unbelievable.
It was unreal. And, you know, like we were talking about before, just flying down to base camp, we landed at the very bottom half of the disaster zone from the avalanche off Pumori, and we had to walk all the way up to the upper half of the disaster zone, which was our camp, and walking and seeing the tents destroyed, you know, seeing the blood on the ground, seeing just how I had no idea how anyone could have survived this disaster. And in our camp, our RMI camp was at the north end of this disaster, the high end of this avalanche zone. And our base camp manager, Mark Tucker, was in the avalanche. He hid behind a big mound, and the avalanche rushed over his head. Another climber that had dropped out, Larry, before we went up the trek, was also in the avalanche. He got buried in his tent, and 10 of our Sherpas got thrown in their tents down the hill in base camp during the avalanche. So it was crazy. That was a crazy experience, just coming down to base camp, seeing the devastation there. And then you're exactly right. So we spent a couple days at base camp to regroup after we got down from Camp 1. And then we determined that, you know, recreating in the mountains when, you know, 9,000 people in Nepal had died from this earthquake and another, you know, 22,000 people were really badly injured and hundreds of thousands of people were homeless. So we decided recreating in the mountains was not morally right.
And you know, it's just one of those circumstances. It's you guys have got to get out of there.
We got to get out of there. Yeah. And the earth is unstable. And at that time, the government hadn't called the season yet. They were still sending up ladders and ropes and supplies down from Namche up to base camp to try to reestablish the route. But most groups were calling it quits and heading down. So.
Mm-hmm. Going back through, I mean, how was it getting out of Nepal? I mean, Matt, obviously you're looking at a situation where, now granted, a lot of things are coming in, so there are planes going back out that are empty. You know, people are sending in aid and stuff. So it's not as if you're taking advantage of in a lot of cases, aid to getting dropped off an empty plane, people getting out of the country, not just necessarily you, but other people. How difficult was it getting out of Nepal at that point?
So we waited up at base camp for 2 days to let everything calm down, because after the earthquake, it was a mad rush of trekkers, of climbers, of everyone just getting down the valley and trying to fly out. And it was just a traffic jam down at the airport. There was fist fights of people trying to get on the planes. It was an absolute mess. So we said, hey, look, we're not gonna deal with this mess. We're gonna wait till everything clears up a bit, and then we're gonna trek out. So we trekked out. It took us 3 days to trek out. Again, it was nice not having as many trekkers on the trail. We kind of had the trail there ourselves. But as you mentioned before, just devastation. Everything was destroyed. There was huge sections of the trail that had been destroyed by boulders falling off from above. There's huge landslides. You could tell that the trekkers had been badly injured or died during the earthquake. And the most touching part for me was we were going down with our Sherpa team, and this is their community. This is where they live. This is where they reside. And each time we'd stop in a little town, and a Sherpa would come up to us and say, "This is my sister's tea house." And you look at the tea house, and it was down to the ground. And it was, you go in there, and she still had stuff set up, and we order tea from her, and you try to do whatever you can to donate whatever cash you had left. Because, these people, they average about $50 a month for their income. So, they don't make a lot of money, and us as tourists are their main form of income. And so the earthquake happening really ended the tourist season extremely early, 2 to 3 months early. And so they're sitting here with no tourists, no income coming in, and all of their houses, their businesses are leveled to the ground.
I'm glad you're back. Very glad you're back. That is one of the more amazing stories I've ever heard. We only have about a minute left here, but I want to say your plea is to go out and visit them, because as you just described, these people need tourism dollars to keep afloat, really. And so even though they are rebuilding and they're still in the rebuilding process, to go out and visit would be a big impact, correct?
That's right. Everyone asks me who they should donate to, what charity they should donate to, and you can find a lot of legit charities online. But my biggest recommendation is just go. Go to Nepal. It's gorgeous. The people are such good people, and you'll love interacting with them. You'll love trekking in gorgeous mountains. Go. Spend your money on a vacation. That's the best thing you can do to help Nepal right now.
Robbie Massey, I'll link to some of those courses later today on the social media. Thank you for coming in and sharing the story. Glad you're back. And by all means, keep us up to date on how things are going, okay?
All right. Thanks so much for having me in, Matt.
My pleasure. Robbie Massey joining us.